Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Side Hustles and Stuff podcast, episode 31. My name is Yuri, and I'm joined by Keishi.
Hey, Yuri. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We are 10 days into January 1st, 2021. Although it still kind of feels like December. Well, if it's the 10th now, it would be December 41st, 2020, because it doesn't feel like the year has changed much.
Yeah, I know. To me, it's still like March or April.
Yeah.
Things stopped.
Yeah. So, well, I guess that's a kind of a lesson. You know, we all expect the moment the clock ticks down and the date switch over, we expect that it's a new day, it's a new year, but really things tend to go on. It's like how you've done things before is how they'll continue to be unless you change something up.
Yeah, exactly. I was always thinking about this when I saw like people's tweets about, oh, finally 2020 is over. And yeah, it's not like coronavirus or whatever cares.
Yeah.
They're not checking calendars. And yeah. I think that's pretty relevant to today's topic, actually.
Yeah. Well, before we get into today's topic, which is pretty awesome, and you guys should keep listening to find out, first we got to cover something important, Keishi, and that is the drinks of the day.
The drinks of the day. All right, so the first drink of the year for me, at least for this podcast, is something called a fruit juice born in Osaka.
Nice.
It looks more like a milk with fruit taste. Mm-hmm. So it used to be like, let's see, it says there's apples, oranges, pineapple, peach and bananas, plus some sort of milk or whatever it is that's mixed with it. Yeah, haven't had it before, but looks good.
So have you tasted it yet or not yet?
Not yet. Mm-hmm. How about yourself?
I have, well, the first drink I have is orange flavored water. Not as good as the peach water, might I add, or the muscat, the grape one.
Yeah.
But not bad. It's a little more subtle. Doesn't taste like Tropicana would or orange juice would.
Yeah.
It's still very cool and refreshing, but between all the flavored waters, I think I prefer peach first and then muscat grape second. And the second one I have is, it's already empty at this point. It's watermelon juice. It's a very small juice box, so it didn't last very long.
So you didn't keep the experience to the podcast recording. You kept just the box.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I'm the type of person that absolutely cannot have snacks or anything delicious in their home, simply because by the time I arrive home, the first thing I do is I jump into the bags and I eat it all. I can't hold back. So like if I open my cupboard or if you check my fridge, you won't find anything there that's delicious because it's been eaten all. It's all been all eaten.
Yeah, it's dangerous to have.
Yeah. So how's the drink?
It's pretty good, actually. I just tried it. It's quite sweet and thick, mm-hmm. but it's good.
Yeah. Like pear juice. Pear juice tends to be thick.
Yeah, something like that, except this tastes a lot like milk.
Okay. And you have a second drink, right?
Yeah, I had a cup of peppermint.
Okay.
Nothing special.
All right. I do have coffee on hand to keep me going, but I figured at this point it's so obvious that there's no point in mentioning it.
All right. So with the drinks out of the way, what is the actual thing that we're talking about?
The actual thing that we're talking about today is how to spot BS. I think it's a very fun topic given where we are with the current state of the world and what's going on around us. And also, it kind of applies back to side hustles. For example, if you want to start your own side hustle and you're looking for a guru that's, for example, a YouTube channel or a podcast guy that's giving you crazy wild promises and you're listening to them and you're inspired, you might not know, but people might be spewing some BS. And this episode, we hope to equip you with the tools to understand BS as you hear it and call it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really relevant right now, especially with so much information out there and everybody being able to put out information as much as they want and things ranging from 100% accurate all the way to completely lunatic going viral on the internet. I think it's a really timely and important topic, I think.
And I think, yeah, like you said, we are in the age of, well, maybe we're in a different age of, but like with the internet, it brought a lot of information to our fingertips. And one can say, now that we have all this information at our fingertips, we should be better, stronger, faster, and blah, blah, blah. But the fact of the matter is that humans might be good at obtaining information on the internet, but we're not exactly always good at analyzing and processing it and discerning which is good, what is bad, what is useless, and what's a straight up lie.
Yeah, exactly. Especially because there's no gatekeepers now, right? I think in the past, even if you had like traditional media, they usually had editors and like editorial process and things like that. And even though all media are biased to some extent, right?
Yeah.
But there's some sort of standard. But nowadays, there's really no standard when it comes to what gets viral and what gets promoted and what gets in front of people.
Yeah, especially with
social media. And what does not. Yeah, exactly.
You could essentially record a video on YouTube, you can record a podcast, push it out there. You're not exactly subject to any regulations or any editorial standards or fact checking. And if you hit it at the park with the right crowd, with the crowd that believes it, then, you know, no one's going to stop you.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's the kind of, I guess you could say, negative side of what we're going to be talking about, which is you got to be careful about this.
Yeah.
And then I guess when it comes to side hustles, then a lot of the things we'll be talking about, and actually what we'll be talking about, we'll kind of formulate as a number of fallacies. A lot of them the listeners might know about, and a lot of them they might hear about for the first time. But I think a lot of these fallacies, when we were going through them before actually recording this, it's like you can flip them around on their head, and kind of marketing strategies.
Yeah, it's a marketing rule. If you take a logical fallacy, flip it on its head, and you'll find it in a marketing book as a marketing rule.
Exactly.
Like, do this to get success.
Exactly. So on one hand, this will help you to spot BS and to be more wary of the information that you consume. And on the other hand, it will also teach you how to convince people better.
Yeah.
Even though not necessarily on a morally higher ground, I guess.
Yeah. So essentially what we're talking about today is logical fallacies. And logical fallacies are simply put bad arguments or BS.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we'll go for like 10 or 15. So do we want to jump into the first one?
All right. Anyway? So the first one we have is called a red herring. And a herring is a fish. So this fallacy, before we get into this fallacy, I want you to imagine, Keishi, I want you to imagine that you are an investigator and you have a bloodhound dog that's on a trail for a criminal, right?
Yeah.
So you're holding the leash and the dog is pulling you in a certain direction and you're walking. The dog's on track. Suddenly the dog comes across a dead stinky fish. That's a herring. Has been placed by the criminal to take you off track.
Okay.
Yeah, so now with that in mind, a red herring introduces an irrelevant point to an argument, and that's a fallacy.
All right, so it kind of tries to distract you from the main point of the argument, or?
Exactly. So, for example, by the way, if anyone's interested, I'm using the book called The Fallacy Detective. It's actually meant for kids and adults. It has a very nice picture of a dog. Cartoony-looking dog on the front. But nevertheless, it's a very good book. So I'm using that as a guide in order to talk about these fallacies today. So here's an example of a red herring. Here's an easy, super easy example. Son says, Dad, why did you go to see the movie The Day of the Spatulas when you said I couldn't? Dad said, it was a really good movie. I'll take you to see it next week. So this is a red herring simply because the dad didn't really answer his question, did he? Injected an irrelevant point into the question, into the argument, or not an argument, into the conversation.
Yeah. Do you have any example that could be related to marketing, or how somebody could use this to mislead someone when promoting a product?
Oh, yeah. Here's a good marketing example inside the book as well. Quote, Sparkle Dent is great for reducing cavities. Dentists say cavities are the number one dental problem in America. And that's a red herring. Because the advertisement says something which is true, that cavities are a problem, but it says nothing about how the actual toothpaste will reduce your cavities. So the way it is shaped, the way the argument is placed, it's a red herring.
Interesting. So this sounds like something that a snake oil salesman could use.
Yes.
And say something like, hey, you should buy this snake oil. It will cure your whatever headache. And headaches are the biggest issue that people have in becoming more productive or something like that.
Yeah. So, you know, someone who's listening who has a headache, they'll be like, yeah, I have a headache. And because those two ideas are connected together, the brain will take a shortcut and make the assumption that snake oil salesman product is connected to headaches because headaches are a number one problem in America, blah, blah, blah. Whereas in reality, the snake oil salesman said really nothing of how the actual product solves headaches. He just threw in an irrelevant point to try and justify his sale. All right, next up we have special pleading. And special pleading is when someone uses a double standard or they argue for an unjustified exception. So essentially you're kind of asking for someone to make a special case for you or special exemption for you, you specifically.
That's an interesting one. Like the first thing that comes to my mind is when you tell somebody that they shouldn't day trade, for example, because it's essentially 95, 96, or whatever the amount is, percent of people fail at it, and they think that they're the 5% that will succeed. Does that count as special pleading or
special pleading is when you want someone to do something for you. For example, here's one: Can I be next in the bathroom? I have to go bad. That's an example of special pleading. You're asking for a special circumstance in your case. Like, for example, also, if you get pulled over by a cop and you start saying, oh, but, you know, I'm special. Can you please let me go? Today's my birthday.
Or is the lady at the in the line at the cashier and is like, hey, I only have two items. Skip you.
Exactly.
Can I skip the line and get in front of you?
Exactly. So that's essentially it. Any thoughts?
Yeah. So I can see how this works in quote unquote real life. I'm trying to think if there's any similar example for this that would be related to marketing or to sales. I can't think of any at the top of my head. Anything?
I mean, I'm sure there are, but like I would have to jog my memory real hard to think of something. But like,
yeah, because
here's one final example. Grandma says, I'm not gambling. This is bingo, not poker. It's different. We're not using a deck of cards. But bingo still can be used for gambling, right?
Yeah.
You're still pleading for something for special exemption.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at the Wikipedia page for this, and it's got a very similar example. It says, I'm not relying on faith in small probabilities here. These are slot machines, not roulette wheels. They are different.
Yeah. So just you're saying like it's this time it'll be different, maybe. I'm different. Yeah. My business is different. That's something you can hear in like the entrepreneurial circle. Like, oh, my business is different. Yeah, I don't need this stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, actually. That's very, very relevant to side hustles, because like you will have people tell you that, oh, I'm not doing A because my business model relies on something different. But like there are some things that are just universal across every business.
Exactly.
Like, just because you're not doing it doesn't mean that you shouldn't be.
Exactly. All right. Ready for the next one?
Sure.
Number three is ad hominem, or which is Latin for to the man. And an ad hominem attack is when you're attacking someone's character or their motives for believing something instead of disproving his actual argument. You know, for example, we shouldn't believe Darwin when he says earthworms are good. He also believes that monkeys can turn into men. This argument attacks Darwin's other theories, not his reasons for saying that earthworms are good. So the person should first examine Darwin's reasons for saying earthworms are good, and he can ignore other theories he may disagree with.
Yeah, I think this happens a lot. Like, people don't know how to respond to an argument, so they just go straight to the person.
The easiest one is like, you know, Senator blah 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 is a liar. You shouldn't listen to his opinion or anything. That's an ad hominem. It's an attack on a person, not their argument.
Yeah.
The moment you go to the person, their past, their history, maybe they were a criminal before, maybe they did something wrong in the past, and you use that to ignore their argument and attack them on that, that's an ad hom. So it's like you're ignoring what they're saying and you're pointing to another thing. By the way, you're wrong. You're a liar. You lied about this in the past. So
yeah. And I think the next one that we have is kind of a special version of ad hom.
Yeah. It's called a genetic fallacy. And basically, it's like if you think of genetic, it goes to the word genesis or beginning. So the genetic fallacy doesn't attack the person making the argument. It attacks the place where the argument came from. So let's say you were raised in a certain religious family, or you're raised in a certain country, and they'll say, oh, you can't have an opinion on X because you were raised in over there. You know, so genetic fallacy is condemning the argument because of where it began, how it began, and who began it.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, because I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page again. It also says that essentially take something that's got a current meaning, and instead it uses the original meaning. Like the example they give here is, you're not going to wear a wedding ring, are you? Don't you know that wedding ring originally symbolized ankle chains worn by women to prevent them from running away from their husbands?
Yeah, that's a genetic fallacy, because you're taking where it came from and you're applying it to present day.
Yeah.
So like the argument essentially is attacks either the person of who began it, how it began, or where it began. So it could be either the person or the topic at hand or the object at hand, for example. It's like saying, you know, you shouldn't use a knife because butter knife, for example, I'm making stuff up here, because butter knives were used in World War I to stab enemies in the eye, and thus they're bad.
Yeah.
Keshi, the funny thing is like a lot of these fallacies, they're very nuanced. So, you know, as I was reading this and learning more about this, it became quite clear how, you know, we can miss this when we're listening, like, because they're kind of nuanced. And someone makes a fallacy, it's easy to miss it and take what someone says as, logical or truthful. Because, you know, genetic fallacy and ad hom, they're quite close. But, you know, if someone doesn't do an ad hom, but they do a genetic fallacy, ad hom is easily spottable. But a genetic fallacy, maybe not so much.
Yeah, and I'm also thinking about, I'm just looking at the wedding ring example here, and it just sounds like there's some point at which point it becomes a fallacy, because like I'm sure if in the beginning they symbolized whatever it is, whatever they symbolized, these ankle chains worn by women, then up until a certain point that was the case, right? And then I guess gradually the meaning changed, so gradually it went from being a valid argument to being a fallacy.
Yeah.
Like there has to be some point where something stops being an argument and starts being a fallacy.
Yeah.
In a way. And yeah, and I think that can be hard to figure out, especially if you're like in the middle of some sort of argument. Like you kind of have to think right away without having much time to think about these things.
Yeah.
It can be pretty hard to.
Yeah. In the moment where you're arguing with someone in the moment, yeah, you can easily miss these things. And later on, you'd be like, oh, wait, that was wrong. All right. Next up, we have this is a Latin word, tu quoque. I hope I'm saying it right, but who knows? And it means you too. Tu quoque is dismissing someone's viewpoint on an issue because he himself is inconsistent in that very thing. So imagine, Casey, someone that's not fit telling you that you should go to the gym. Like most people will be like, most people will reply, oh, but you yourself don't look like you've been to the gym lately. And, you know, anyone watching at the sidelines will be like, haha, yeah, he's a hypocrite. He's right. You got him there with that zinger. But that does not disqualify his argument. It's, you know, kind of like a smoker telling you should quit smoking.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is, at first you should examine his argument before his, you know, him, and see if there's validity in that argument.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think, just to bring it back into kind of the side hustling slash marketing slash business space. Yeah, so let's say Warren Buffett tells you that you should invest into the S&P 500 and you should essentially invest passively and just buy index funds or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody goes and says, oh, he shouldn't say that because he's picking his individual stocks and not investing in the index fund passively. That kind of sounds like this sort of fallacy.
Yeah.
Just because Warren Buffett's telling you to do A, but he's doing B, doesn't mean that what he's telling you is bad.
Yeah.
There might be some differences in context, or might be just different situation, or there's many things beyond just what the person is telling you to do, right?
I think there's a separate fallacy. I'm not sure what the specific name for it is. It's like a hypocrisy fallacy, or a fallacy to, I don't know, something related to hypocrisy. And, you know, like in an argument, someone that's hypocritical, they're an easy target. And most people will side against the person that's being hypocritical, right?
Yeah.
However, you know, just because someone's hypocritical about something does not disprove their argument.
Yeah, exactly.
So if someone says, oh, you're being a hypocrite because X, Y, and Z, but if their statement is original, if their initial argument is valid, that's, you know, then you're committing a fallacy right there.
Yeah, like one thing that comes to my mind is, like, this is just an example, but like you were mentioning the smoker.
Mm-hmm.
And like, if you imagine a smoker that's like 75 years old and has like lung cancer or something, and that person telling like a 20-year-old smoker that he should stop smoking, like that sounds like that would be a case of, I'm not even going to try to pronounce this Latin word, but
tu quoque.
Tu quoque.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, that person's been doing it and is doing it, but maybe there's even some lesson from the person that's actually doing it that makes that person recommend that did you not do it.
Yeah. I think it's also a very common fallacy that you'd hear or read if you're scrolling through Facebook.
Yeah. Do you have some specific example?
Nah. Not off the top, but it's something like you would find it everywhere in YouTube comments, Facebook comments, should you scroll through and decide to kill an hour of your time. But I don't think that's a good use of time. All right. Next up, we have faulty appeal to authority. So going back to marketing, you know, you use authorities in your marketing to bolster up your marketing points or your advertisement. Right, like,
yeah. I think for this, you just have to look at the back of pretty much any book and see the recommendations that they usually use.
Yeah. So a faulty appeal to authority is an appeal to someone who has no special knowledge in the area being discussed. For example, I'm having trouble playing my violin. Do you have any suggestions? Mechanic. Maybe if you blow in the other end instead. That's a faulty appeal to authority, because a mechanic is not exactly an authority on violins.
Yeah, I just picked up a book that I have on my desk. It's the origin story book, and on the back it's got the most powerful example of interdisciplinary scholarship that I know of, quote by Fareed Zakaria, CNN. Mm. And it's like, sure, this person might be known, but they also didn't probably study all the different interdisciplinary scholarship books that are out there. So like essentially just using somebody's name to give something authority, even though they're not necessarily an authority in the space, right?
Well, the first step there would be to examine that person specifically, like look up their name and see what their qualifications and experience are, and then you make the call, you know. But but in the case of that specific journalist, I'm not familiar, but the first step would be, before, you know, making any claims, just to do the research first and see what their qualifications are and if they have any relevant experience in said field.
And the interesting thing is actually that on Wikipedia it also says that some people consider it to be always a fallacy when somebody cites an authority as the main as the main argument, which I think is interesting too when you think about it. Like, even if the authority is like, let's say you're trying to sell a toothpaste or something, and you cite and you tell that whichever dentist recommends this because blah blah blah, then just because he's a dentist doesn't mean that he's right. So I think that's what they're trying to say here, is that for some people, just the fact that you're referring to some sort of quote unquote authority as the main argument, that itself makes it a fallacy, regardless of whether it's a relevant authority or not.
Yeah, but you know, the first step in all of this is to, before making that call, you examine their argument and what they bring to the table and make a call on that before jumping in and saying that's wrong.
I think that's kind of the main thing, is like, regardless of who says whatever it is, just go to the core of the argument and think about the argument itself. Don't think about who said the argument.
Exactly. All right, ready for the next one?
Let's go. Just one last note. I think this, out of all the arguments that we talk, I feel like this is one of the arguments that you'll see most used in marketing. Put out random big names.
It's a social proof when you have when you're listing all the companies that you work with as a way to say, oh hey, I'm working with all these companies, as such I am a trusted authority, or per se.
Yeah.
Or I've been mentioned in the following newspapers, as such I'm a trusted authority, which may or may not be the case. Everything see, the other part of learning these logical fallacies, that they're still not particularly mental shortcuts, because, you know, someone listening here might be like, all right, fine, cool. If I learn these special 10, 15, 20, 35 rules, I'll be able to spot BS from a mile away. And everything has to be examined on a case-by-case basis before you actually call it BS.
Yeah.
So, you know, before you make the call, you have to just make sure, like, you know, is this true? Is this not? What is the argument? Does it make sense? So it's, you know, that's why I think this stuff is so hard, because you have to stop and examine every single point. And that's why we miss a lot of these things. All right. Ready for the next one?
Bring it on.
All right. Next one is appeal to the people. I think this is also very much marketing related. And the appeal to the people means that it's when we claim our viewpoint is correct because many other people agree with it. In other words, saying, we have 10,000 customers using our product, for which they're trying to imply, as such, we're a good company, or our product is good. Or, like, you know, we had like 10,000 downloads.
Yeah.
But that does not, that has nothing to do with the actual performance of the product and if it actually works.
Yeah. This sounds like democracy to me. Just because most people choose somebody, or just because whoever was chosen by the most people does something, doesn't mean it's necessarily right. It just happens to be the most popular.
It's funny you say that. In the book, it says, this fallacy is very similar to the faulty appeal to authority. If it is wrong to appeal to someone who isn't an authority, then it is just as wrong to appeal to many people who are not authorities. The general public is rarely a proper authority on any subject.
Yeah.
For example, political candidate, my opponent thinks that this war is killing innocent people, despite the fact that a recent poll concluded that 76% of citizens think it's okay. So the general public is not an authority on moral issues like this. This is an appeal to the people. Or in other words, you know, this book, The Fallacy Detective, must be a best logic book around. It has been a bestseller. It has been on the bestseller list for months. That's also an appeal to the people.
Yeah. I think this is another one that, like you said, that you see in the marketing a lot. And also, I think when you, when you look at different products, I guess this is also kind of the difference between a good product and good marketing, right? Just because a product is selling a lot doesn't mean it's the best product on the market. Like, I think you could have similar argument between, like, whatever, Windows computers and Mac computers and things like that, where just because something has the largest market share doesn't mean it's also the best thing on the market.
Exactly. So how do you feel as we're running through all these fallacies? What makes you, what does it make you think?
That's a good question. I think as human, I don't think we're able to completely eliminate these, right? I think that they're kind of a mix of emotionality and rationality. And I definitely think it's good to know about them. I don't think we can completely eliminate them from our own thinking either. Like you can know all these and you can still fall victim to every single one of these, just because one, sometimes they're really hard to spot. And sometimes you just want to believe what you want to believe, right? It's like sometimes you might even know down there that that is a fallacy that you're falling victim to, but you still want to buy the product because somebody tells you that 10,000 other people bought it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the evergreen time-limited funnels that you see, like, oh, if you buy within the next 2 hours, you will get a 50% discount or whatever. And you know that if you just clear your cookies or whatever and go back to the site, and then you'll always get the 2-hour timer. And you know that essentially that's it's not a true, what do you call it? It's not really time-limited or whatever. But you still kind of feel the pressure to buy it right now. And I think that's kind of similar to this, where like you can know about all of these, and it's definitely good to know about them, but you really can't avoid them 100% of the time.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't disagree with that. I think they're just nice to know. Yeah, but I guess more so like when you're listening to like political statements and stuff and people trying to argue their way into certain points, that's when like my mind goes on red alert and starts scanning for everything. Starts like running these statements back and forth, like past what I know and what kind of fallacies I know.
I think it's definitely good to know them. And I think knowing them is the key to kind of thinking critically about things.
Yeah.
Because if you just take everything at its face value, then you're probably going to believe a lot of things that are not true, or that have been concluded out of fallacies that just don't make much logical sense.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I absolutely agree. It's good to know them. Yeah. And also, again, if you're a marketer if you're trying to sell something, then sometimes the best way to sell, or oftentimes the best way to sell, is just to take these things that we're talking about, flip them on their head, and use them, quote unquote, against the people that you're trying to sell to, right?
Yeah, because people buy on emotion, and essentially these illogical fallacies, you flip them upside down, they're emotional appeals.
Exactly.
All right. So next one is an interesting one, and it's also a very tricky one. I think it's one of the most common logical fallacies that you would encounter in most arguments or discussions.
Yeah.
And it's called the straw man. So the straw man argument is when you change or exaggerate your opponent's position to make it easier to argue against. So here's an example for you. A mother yells at her son and she says, "I think you've been playing too many of those video games lately." And the son is like, "Oh, so you think I should just throw away my $1,000 video game collection?" So yeah. Here the son is not exactly addressing her point of maybe he's, you know, spending too much time with video games and staring at the screen. But he takes her point and he changes it up, and he approaches her point from the fact that he spent $1,000 on it. So he's not addressing your point. He's changing it up.
Yeah, if you have some more.
Here's one. Man on the street says, "I'm opposed to capital punishment." Man on the sidewalk says, "Oh, you people who oppose punishing criminals make me sick. Don't you ever think about the poor victims at all?" So again, one person says they're against capital punishment. The other person twists their argument to something else and like just accuses him, "Don't you think about the victims of the crime?" So he's not addressing the argument, he's avoiding it, and he's taking it to something else, you know, the poor victims.
Yeah, I think this is, like I said, this is one of the ones that you really see the most, because it's also kind of easy to just take whatever the other person says and take it to the very extreme or beyond the extreme and argue that way.
They're also very tricky to spot, you know, because here's one more example. Political candidate A, "Due to this year's budget problems, I think the state should decrease the amount of money going to schools. This would solve the problem. We could bring the amount of money back to the schools to normal next year." Candidate B, "My fellow citizens, is this what you want in a candidate? Someone who's against our schools, against our education, and against our future?"
Yeah, that sounds like something you would see on a TV in a political debate a lot.
Yeah, so it's a guy one says, you know, "We have budget problems, so we should decrease money to schools for 1 year and bring them back." The other one completely warps his stance around and says, "Do you want someone who's against schools and children in our future?" Which is not the point that A was trying to make.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page here. But it essentially, it it gives some examples of how you can do this. And I think by far the most common ones are quoting an opponent's words out of context, which would kind of be what we're talking about. Oversimplifying an opponent's argument and then attacking this oversimplified version, or exaggerating an opponent's argument and then attacking the exaggerated version.
Usually I think some of these arguments start with, you know, person A says something and then person B says, so what you're saying is, usually, well, I don't know if it's usually, but so what you're saying is, insert reframed position of argument. So what you're saying is blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, the example they give here is we should relax the beer law, the laws on beer. It's A. And then the reply is, no, any society with unrestricted access to intoxicants loses its work ethic and goes only for immediate gratification.
Yeah.
So I guess it's kind of like, oh, that escalated quickly.
It also includes slippery slope in there, which is something we'll cover in a bit.
Yeah.
Ready for the next one?
Sure. What's
the next? Next one is called the loaded question. And a loaded question is when someone asks two questions in one question, but one is hidden behind the other. So that question includes an assumption that you did not agree to.
All right. Do you have an example?
So, for example, when an advertisement says, so when are you going to make the new Ford Bubble Box your first car? That's a loaded question because it assumes that you're interested in buying a Ford or a car in the first place. Another one would be, you know, a neighbor says, why do you like to disturb the neighborhood by playing your music so loud that everyone can hear it from a mile away? And it kind of implies, how do you know that the music can be heard so far? And that it also implies that you like to disturb, you know, it assumes a bunch of things.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So I guess any question that has some sort of assumption that's potentially not true would fall under this.
Yeah. Here's one. Child to mother. Why is the president always so grumpy? Is it because he wanted to be an astronaut instead, but his mother made him become president? That's a loaded question because, you know, the kid is assuming that the guy is always grumpy. So, like, why are you always so blah, blah, blah? That would be a loaded question. Yeah. Or magazine ad. Does the pain medication you use now start to work in less than a second? That's a loaded question. Because should pain medicines work in 1 second at all in general?
Yeah. Do you have any idea how this could be flipped and used?
Oh, of course.
That's in marketing?
Well, especially in marketing copy, you know, you present a loaded question in the introduction. Like you give them something that sounds good. For example, it's like, don't you want your dog to learn new tricks in 5 minutes or less? And it's like, so the loaded question, the assumption here is that a dog can learn a trick in 5 minutes or less. Let's say 1 minute or less, right? The assumption is that a dog can learn a trick in a minute or less. And that's what the ad is kind of relying for you to accept. And also it sounds good to you. So you'll kind of like accept that. But you're not addressing the, you know, so it's 2 points in one. Learn trick and learn trick in a minute or less. So can a dog learn a trick? Yes, it can. But can the dog, and the hidden part is, you know, a minute or less. It's like that you're not asking yourself that you should ask. Is it possible for a dog to even learn a trick in a minute or less?
I see. So would something like, did you always want to lose 10 kilos without exercising, sort of?
Yeah. Let's see. Did you always want to lose 10 kilograms? Have you always wanted to lose 10 kilograms without exercising? Yeah, there is a hidden assumption in there that, you know, one can lose weight without exercising.
Or without dieting, or whatever.
Yeah. I think I've had people ask me loaded questions in the past, and, you know, like they ask you and you answer it, but then your brain is like, wait, something felt wrong about that question, but I'm not sure what it was.
I'm looking at some historic examples here, and it says Madeleine Albright.
Yeah.
As ambassador to the UN, fell into a trap of answering loaded question and later regretted not challenging it instead on 60 Minutes in 6 when Leslie Stahl asked about the effects of UN sanctions to Iraq. Quote, we have heard that 500,000 children died. I mean, that is more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? Mm. And so instead of questioning this unattributed death toll on how much of it could have been due to sanctions, Albright said, I think that is a very hard choice, but the price, I think the price is worth it. And then Albright said about it, I must have been crazy. I should have answered the question by reframing it and pointing out the inherent flaws in the premise behind it. As soon as I had spoken, I wished for the power to freeze time and take back those. My reply had been a terrible mistake. Hasty, clumsy, and wrong. I had fallen into a trap and said something that I simply did not mean. That is no one's fault but my own. I guess this is a good lesson in, like, when somebody gives you a question, rather than trying to reply as quickly as possible. Just think through it. It might just as well be loaded.
Yeah. When you are distracted, I think any one of us could make that mistake. Because again, it requires you to stop and think and not react.
Yeah, or here's another one from the Wikipedia page, which is from a New Zealand referendum on corporal punishment in New Zealand. It says, should a smack as part of good parental correction be a criminal offense in New Zealand? And then one of the people criticized it as loaded and ambiguous because the question presumes that smacking is a part of good parental behavior, or good parental.
Yeah.
So I guess, the point is just always look at all the assumptions that are made within some sort of question and make sure that they're reasonable. Yeah.
Ready for the next one?
Yeah, let's go on to the next one.
The next one is called equivocation. And equivocation is when you change the meaning of a word in the middle of an argument. And I think this can also be called a play on words, and you probably would hear it a lot in comedy.
Yeah.
So here's an example. If the English don't drive on the right side of the road, what are they doing on the wrong side? So here, they take the word right, and they change the meaning of it from, you know, right hand, left hand, to right versus wrong. So I think more often than not, you will hear this in humor than actual, like, speeches and whatnot, because you can kind of spot this easily, and you kind of, you know, you can see it as a joke more so than an actual intelligent argument.
Yeah.
At least I'd like to hope so. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of some example where it would actually be like a serious situation, but I'm having a hard time. Since only man is rational and no woman is a man, therefore no woman is rational would be a equivocation where man's meant to mean human, and then in the second case it's meant to mean male. A feather is light. What is light cannot be dark. Therefore a feather cannot be dark.
Here's one. Dorothy, you know, like what's that Dorothy in Kansas, the scarecrow thing? What is it called? The Wizard of Oz, right? You know about the Wizard of Oz?
I heard about the movie, but I've never seen
it. Well, here's an example from that. Dorothy, are you doing that on purpose, or can't you make up your mind? Scarecrow says, that's the trouble. I can't make up my mind. I haven't got a brain, just a straw. Dorothy, how can you talk if you haven't got a brain? Scarecrow, I don't know, but some people without brains do an awful lot of talking, don't they? Dorothy, yeah, I guess you're right. So the scarecrow is changing the meaning of brain. First, he's talking about the physical organ and that he lacks it. And then later he's using it to talk about someone who doesn't have like wisdom or common sense. Yeah. So I think, you'd probably see this more so in comedy, but still good to know.
Definitely. So, want to go to the next one?
Yep.
Number 11.
Next up, we have the slippery slope. I think the slippery slope is another common one that you would hear. The slippery slope fallacy assumes that if we take one step, nothing will stop us from taking a series of steps because each step is the same. It's essentially, you're assuming that because you take one step, that one step will lead to the worst possible conclusion at the end. For example, you know, let's say a family has two dogs, right? And the mom is like, we can't let our daughter have another dog. And the father's like, we can handle two dogs in the house. She loves animals. And the mom says, two dogs? She'll ask for three, four, five, six. This isn't going to stop. So the mother here is committing a slippery slope fallacy, thinking that they'll end up with like 20 dogs, which is not the case. You know, she'll say, why stop at three dogs? Maybe she'll ask for 1,000 dogs. Here's another one. Mrs. says, we're not turning the air conditioner on. It's only 89 degrees. The mister says, I'm dripping. The missus says, you didn't complain when it was 80 or 88. So 89 isn't any different. That's a slippery slope too.
Yeah.
Here's a review. Remember special pleading. You can't give me a ticket for speeding. I'm the mayor of the town.
For the slippery slope, actually the temperature one that you mentioned, I think is a good example of why things are not always as bad as one would expect, at least based on the slippery slope arguments. Mm-hmm. Like there's always some inherent limits to what people are willing to do. Like the part that we cut out about speeding. Like sure, somebody like if there's no death penalty for driving about for driving too fast, it's not like somebody will drive 250 kilometers per hour just because there's no punishment for it other than fine. It's like there's some sort of limit. It's like
the car.
If the limit is 130. Yeah, if the limit is 130 kilometers per hour, somebody will go 140. But very few people will go 150 or 160 or 170.
Yeah, and which point is like, can your car even go that fast? Can your car even go that fast with other cars on the road? Can your car even go that fast without swerving out of control?
Yeah.
Here's another one, actually, that I kind of like, another example of a slippery slope. Camper A to camper B. Can you change your t-shirt? You've been wearing it all week and it really smells. Camper B says, why? The shirt was fine on Monday. You had no complaints on Tuesday, no problem Wednesday. All of a sudden, something's wrong with it. So I think you could take this back and be like, you know, if something bad was going on and people were fine with it back then, but now people are no longer fine with it. And someone says, why are you complaining now? You've been fine with it all this time. You know, that's still like, if it's bad, then it's bad. Then they still have a point.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it also shows that there's a certain breaking point for all these things. Like, just because your t-shirt was fine for 6 days doesn't mean that it will be fine for 7 days, because if it's fine for 7 days, it will be fine for 8 days. And things just don't work. Like, it's at some point, you're just going to be on some sort of line where it's like, all right, you just smell at this point and there's no going back.
Yeah. But you were fine with it yesterday. Like, yeah, I was trying to be nice. But here's one, final one. I really like Slippery Slope. Here's a final one from the Scopes Monkey Trial, 1925. If today you can take a thing like evolution, make it a crime to teach in the public schools, tomorrow you can make it a crime to teach it in private schools. Next year you can make it a crime to teach it to the hustings or in the church. At the next session, you may ban books and the newspapers. Ignorance and fanaticism are ever busy and need feeding, always feeding and gloating for more. Today it is the public school teachers, tomorrow the private, the next day the preachers and lecturers, the magazines, the books, the newspaper, and after a while, Your Honor, it is the setting of man against man and creed against creed until with flying banners and beating drums, we are marching backwards towards the glorious age of the 16th century when people lit torches to burn the men who dared bring any intelligence and enlightenment and culture to the human mind. That's a slippery slope. You know, I mean, like the guy, you know, he had a good, like, you know, like this goes back to the topic of evolution, which we're not going to argue because it's unrelated to anything that we talk about. But even people making the right arguments can still make fallacies.
Yeah.
Are you ready for the next one?
Sure.
All right. Next one. It's a bit two in one. Part to whole and whole to part. So first up is part to whole. And part to whole is when someone says that what is true of a part of something must be true also of the whole thing. So that's the part to whole fallacy. So for example, if you think of a pillow, right? Pillow has feathers. Feathers are light. If you follow that logic, if you say, oh, feathers are light, by that logic, a pillow must also be light. If a child says, mommy, why is this feather pillow so heavy? It just has feathers in it and little feathers don't weigh anything. That is a part to whole fallacy. You're assuming that the quality of a part that makes up a whole will have the same qualities of the whole just because it's made of those parts.
So that would be like an all-stars team in sport, right? It's like taking all the best players and putting them together.
You know, like also for, I guess in marketing, you would say, you know, this thing is made up from the best little pieces and as such, or we have the best, or if you use the best ingredients on a cake, just because you have the best ingredients, the best parts, doesn't mean that the cake itself will be great.
Oh, I can see that sort of that. We only use organic, high quality ingredients.
Yeah.
And then assuming the final product.
Yeah.
I guess you could also see something like, I don't know, this desk was made out of the highest quality wood that one can get.
But that says something about the parts, but that doesn't say about the actual desk. Maybe the wood breaks down once you, like, you know, chop it up and assemble it into a desk. Maybe it no longer is as good as the actual part was.
Yeah.
So, like you said, also, here's an example. Team USA was selected from the best players in the United States. Since they're all the best at their positions, the team is going to win. That's a part to whole fallacy because you're assuming that just because each individual player is best at their position, you're assuming that they will play well together as a team, which isn't the case. If you put a bunch of egotistical hotheads together.
Yeah, I guess this is, I'm not sure if this is 100% relevant to this, but like what comes to my mind when we talk about this and when we talk about the all-star teams, but the team not necessarily being as good as kind of each of the players within the team.
Mm-hmm.
Like what I imagine is kind of just to kind of connect it for a while back to the side hustles and things like that. It's like I imagine a guy that sits at home and does nothing because he's saving money for the best camera equipment that is out there so that he can make YouTube videos and start a YouTube channel.
Yeah. And he has the best lighting. He has the best software for editing. But that doesn't mean that final product that he's going to put out will be any good if he puts out a product at all.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's a good point. You want to jump into whole to part?
Sure. So that's the other way around, I guess, right?
Yeah. So it's when someone says what is true of something as a whole must also be true of each of its parts. That's the whole to part fallacy. In this year's games, Team America has won more medals than any other team in history. So Jim, who's on Team America, must be a great athlete. So you assume just because the team is great that certain individual players are great too. But that's an assumption, you know, that's a fallacy because maybe Jim was the guy that was sitting on a bench the whole time.
Yeah, like the first thing that comes to my mind here, again, taken kind of from the business viewpoint, is like big brands. Let's say a brand gets popular selling iPhones and MacBooks, right? Let's take Apple. Mm. And I think we can pretty much agree that both iPhones and MacBooks are pretty good pieces of equipment. But that doesn't mean that that the Apple car will be a really good car.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're assuming that just because Apple is a great company that produces great products, you're assuming that the car will be great as well.
Yeah, it's almost kind of also part of the, what was it? The false authority?
Yeah.
Faulty appeal to authority. Just because Apple makes good computers doesn't mean they'll make good cars. It's part of that. And also, I guess, also part of this. And I think just brand recognition and brands in general kind of apply to this, where it's like, just because something's made by a brand that generally considered to be a good brand doesn't mean that brand doesn't have any flops or any bad product.
Mm. All right, let's close it off real quick. Harvard Law is a very prestigious school. I'm sure this new lawyer must be a prestigious person since he graduated from Harvard. Again, you're assuming whole to part that just because someone is from a certain place doesn't mean that they're as good as that certain place is known to be for.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great example. And again, I think it just comes back to brands and to being known. Essentially, brands take advantage of this, right?
Yeah.
Like if you look at all sort of licensing and stuff like that, when somebody wants to put some logo on a thing, it's usually because people associate some sort of attributes. In this case, let's say it's good or whatever with that brand. And then you take the logo and slap it on something else. Then a lot of people will automatically take those attributes and associate them with whatever product they slap the logo on, even if that's not necessarily the case. Yeah.
That's a word of the day, heuristic. It's a mental shortcut, and marketing exploits the heuristics. You know, if someone looks at that advertisement, they'll make the connection that, oh, that company is good and you have the logo there, that means you're good.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, ready for the next one?
Sure.
Next one is very common. It's called the either-or fallacy. So when someone asserts that we must choose between two things, when in fact we have more than two alternatives, he's using the either-or fallacy. And the funny picture here is, in the book I'm looking at, is give me liberty or give me death. Well, yeah. So basically, when someone presents you with only two options or a very limited amount of options and force you to choose between those, like my way or the highway, if you don't like it, then you should leave, blah, blah, blah. Those are examples of either or. It's also called a false dichotomy. And I think you can also see it in marketing. It's like, you know, would you like to A, have a messy room, or B, have the best cleaning product on the market? So it's like, first of all, it can also contains an assumption. It's a loaded question. But at the same time, it's only giving you with two choices. And the person that's not going to really think through will be like, oh, of course I want the clean room, not the messy room. And I want that product.
Yeah. I think thinking about it, a lot of marketing messages are this, essentially, right? It's like, you either get our product or we will keep having this problem.
Yeah.
But in reality, there's their product and there's like 10 different solutions to the problem versus like every company likes to present itself as the only solution to the problem because that's what people are looking for, right? And like the other thing that kind of comes to my mind is like when you see these pop-ups where people want you to sign up to their newsletter, mm-hmm, or where people want to want you to subscribe or something. Like sometimes it just says yes and no, but oftentimes they'll come up with this type of copy that I really don't like, which is like, hey, do you want this free PDF guide to whatever? And then financial the two freedom buttons, yeah, to financial freedom. And then it says, yes, I want to be financially free, or no, I don't want to be financially free.
Or no, I want to be a slave and work for a wage for the rest of my life.
Yeah, or something like that. And it's like, there's other options too. It's like, sure, I want to be financially free, but I don't care about your PDF or whatever it is that you're offering.
So yeah, it's very common in copywriting because you know, the less choices you give a person, the easier it is for them to make that choice. But at the same time, they can be guided in the wrong direction by being presented a certain set of choices.
Yeah, I think this one's interesting because exactly in general, like when you're choosing things, you don't like having too many options, right? And I feel like it's easier to choose when there's fewer options. But then at the same time, when you limit your options, then you're potentially excluding what the actual right choice for you is.
For number 14, we have, this is also Latin. So for those of you tuning in, you're learning a bit of language along the way. The 14th fallacy, this is, by the way, we have one more after this. So this is second to last. So you're almost done. Don't worry, keep listening. It's called the post hoc ergo propter hoc. So in Latin, this means after this, therefore, because of this. So this fallacy says that since A happened before B, A must have caused B.
Interesting. So this is kind of a more specific version of correlation doesn't equal causation, right?
Yeah. Like, for example, the weatherman announces that there will be a drop in the temperature later today. And then when the drop comes, you know, someone out there might think because the weatherman said there'll be a drop, the weatherman caused the drop. Can you think of any business examples?
Yeah, I think this is one that you see in online marketing a lot. And I think it's highly relevant to side hustles. It's like when you listen to people talking about blogging, you'll often hear them say, I did this, so this happened. Like, I published 30 articles a month, so one a day for 5 months, and then my blog made $2,000, right? So it's easy to say, because I did this, this happened. But oftentimes there's many more factors in play. And I think this is what kind of makes, this is how people try to prove that their course works, like whatever. John followed my course, so they made $500 with their blog within the first year. But again, it doesn't necessarily have to be because they followed the course. There might have been like a million other variables. Like, for example, like with my blog, it surely grew because I published a lot of content. And it would be easy to say, oh, I published 60 articles a month for a year. So it grew from whatever amount to like 10 times that amount. But then if you look under the hood, there's also things like, oh, the Christmas was coming. So there more people are searching for like product related terms. Or, oh, because of COVID-19, everybody was staying at home. So more people are searching for the topic that the blog is about than they usually would. So like there's always many more factors at play than what you can see on the surface. And I think this is what pretty much every single I'll teach you how to build an online business course plays on. It's like, hey, if you follow my 10 strategies, you will be making a lot of money, sort of.
But by the way, it also kind of sounds like a jumping to a conclusion. Like, for example, here's one. Ever since they put up that new power plant across the river, we haven't had a bit of rain. I'm telling you, mankind has gotten too big for its britches when it fiddles around with nature. So this guy assumes that since they built that new power plant, A leads to B, less rain. So power plants lead to less rain, you know? So jumping to the conclusion, not really looking at what else could have been happening. Like you mentioned, it could be a lot of other reasons.
Yeah.
Definitely, it's definitely done in business, you know, because A has happened to me or B has happened, A has happened to me. Therefore, I am B. I'm successful.
Yeah, I think a lot of teaching is based on this. Like people look at what they've done and then they attribute whatever happened to them to the factors that they've done. Whereas there's, like in everything, there's strategy involved, there's effort involved, but there's also a certain portion of luck involved. And by luck, I mean, it can be anything. It can be like your environment, like the family you were born into, or just the timing, or like a million other things that are out of your control.
Yeah.
And I like to disregard those things that are out of our control and attribute everything to the things that are within our control, just because it feels better. We like to be in control first.
I think that's when you hear someone saying that they're a self-made man or they're responsible for their own success, but they could probably be overlooking a lot of luck and factors that are outside of the control, probably up to other people.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I'm not saying that it's not possible to say that that you've done A, B, and C, and then X, Y, and Z happened. But again, it's not always just the A, B, and C. There's also D, E, F, and G that you might not be aware of. So it's hard to draw like a really precise, I did this, so this happened. Especially in business where there are so many different factors in play.
Yeah.
Like in physics, it's easy, right? You kick a ball, and the ball flies, and the ball hits the wall. And then it bounces back, and it hits another wall, and then it bounces back. Because there's like every action has a certain reaction in physics or in chemistry or whatever in science. But with things like business, there it's not always as simple as action A leads to action B or reaction B. There's also other factors.
Yeah, well said. All right, ready for the last one?
Sure. What's the last one?
Proof by lack of evidence. And this fallacy is when you're claiming something is true simply because no one has given evidence to the contrary. Like, for example, I could say, you know, Keishi, there are no mountain lions living in Tokyo. And you can ask me, you know, how do you know that? And I tell you, well, prove to me that there are some.
That one's really hard to argue against.
Yeah. But that's the thing. Like, you know, I'm asking you to prove it. I'm relying on the fact that no one has provided proof. As such, my point is true because no one proved me wrong yet.
Yeah, I think this is where presumption of innocence comes to play. Like if somebody says, like if I say, hey, you killed whoever, and the only proof I give is that there's no proof that you didn't kill that person, you're pretty screwed.
I think in all cases, the person who makes the assertion is the one who must provide the evidence.
Yeah.
All right, here's an example. Ready?
Yep.
Torture. You are a spy. You can't prove that you aren't one, so you're a spy. Confess, or we will stretch your body out until you're a foot taller. Accused. Ha. You did it. You committed a fallacy. I learned all about it in a book called The Fallacy Detective. Torture. That's enough cheek out of you. Brutus, give the wheel another turn. So it's proof by lack of evidence. And actually, The Simpsons, I think, there was a Simpsons episode where Lisa tells Homer, you know, like, I could say that this rock keeps bears away. He's like, Homer's like, well, how does it work? Lisa's like, well, do you see any bears around? Like, no, then it works. Oh, well, maybe that's not really, it's loosely related. But the whole point of this fallacy is that you're relying on the fact that there is no evidence to prove your point. Any thoughts?
Yeah, so I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page, favorite thing to do today. But it says that that statements that begin with, I can't prove it, but ... are often this type of fallacy.
Hmm.
And it's kind of how conspiracy theories are born, I guess, right? It's like, I can't prove this.
Prove it, yeah. They say, I can't prove it, but you have to prove me wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Just because you can't prove me wrong doesn't mean that I'm right.
Hmm. So it's also called an argument from ignorance or appeal to ignorance.
Yeah.
For example, yeah, there is no compelling evidence that UFOs are not visiting Earth. Therefore, UFOs exist, and there is intelligent life elsewhere in the universe.
Yeah, and I think, just to kind of look back, I think out of all these 15 that we talked about, in a way, this is the one that's kind of the hardest to argue against. Because like whoever's arguing this viewpoint, they're convinced that lack of evidence is the evidence, right, in a way. So unless you go out there and actually not find a UFO, which is impossible. Like, it's really impossible to prove, I think, or to argue against. In a way, I feel like it's kind of the most ridiculous of them all.
Yeah, it is hard to argue with it. Because essentially, you two, the person A and person B, are not arguing on the same platform in the first place.
This goes beyond argument. It's like the person is essentially convinced. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like how can you argue against
it? So, in a way, I guess maybe it's the logic versus emotion. Because one of them has to have been convinced by emotion and belief. Whereas the other one is going by logic. So essentially, they're arguing from two different philosophies, and they'll never reach conclusion because simply they're not on the same playing level.
Yeah, because another example here on the Wikipedia page is, there is no evidence of aliens, and therefore aliens do not exist. Unless you find some sort of evidence that aliens exist, you're never going to convince this person that aliens can potentially exist.
Yeah.
Right, but once you find the evidence, then it's not even potentially, just aliens exist. But I feel like this is the type of person that would then go and say, oh yeah, but this evidence is not enough to say that aliens.
And they start pushing the bar and raising the bar. Or the goalposts, pushing the goalposts, I think. My friend John is insane. He doesn't look like it, but he's madder than a March's hair. He may look perfectly normal on the outside, but you know, you never know when he'll up and do something crazy. Yep, deep down, he's a raving lunatic. Now, you may ask, how do I know this? Well, can you prove to me that he's sane? I bet you can't. I guess when someone makes a claim, and because the burden of proof is always falls upon the accuser. So if you're making the accusation, you must follow up with proof.
Yeah.
Essentially, all they're doing is they're shifting the burden of proof to the the opposite party. They're making a statement, but they're not providing proof, and they're sending it, passing it to the other guy.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. It's like just making a random statement and then saying, hey, can you prove me wrong? Rather than you being the one that proves that whatever you're saying is right.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is definitely tricky to argue against. But, you know, I at least you can spot it, and you can know when to walk away if an argument reaches this level of discourse.
Yeah. I'd say out of the 15, this one is the only one that's hard to argue against.
Well, I guess the lesson here is maybe you don't argue with them in the first place if it reaches that level, because there's no winning this one. But I think also, no, you're right.
Prove me wrong.
Yeah. I'll do my best. All right, so we just covered 15 fallacies from the book Fallacy Detective by Nathaniel Bluedorn and Hans Bluedorn. Of course, there's a ton more other fallacies we have not mentioned that are likely not mentioned in the book, but it was a nice primer towards learning how to argue and spot BS should it come your way. If you're interested in the book, you can check it out in the show notes. Keishi, any final thoughts for the day?
Yeah, I think my only thought would be to get the book that we'll post in the show notes, or to read about this in Wikipedia or some other sources. There's also books like Predictably Irrational and other similar books that deal with the topic of how people think in kind of biased way or in terms of fallacies. Mm. And just to be aware of them. I think a lot of times it's really unavoidable to either say something that's a fallacy or to fall victim to a fallacy. But if you learn about these, and if you read about them, and if you listen about them, and if you talk about them, then you're more likely to spot them.
Yeah.
And again, I think in some cases it doesn't make sense to try to argue against it because the stakes are too low. But in other cases, it might be really important for you to try to convince somebody and to try to bring some more logic into an argument. Or if you're trying to, or if you're watching like a political debate or something, it also gives you a better view of like who has solid arguments and who is just using kind of your emotional weaknesses against you in a way.
Yeah.
And then lastly, if you're a marketer, if you're trying to sell something, then you can take all these and flip them around and kind of deploy them as your marketing strategy.
Yeah, that's about right. I wouldn't add anything more.
All right.
So guys, be sure to check out the show notes at sidehustlesandstuff.com/E31, where we will list out the fallacies as well as the title of the book. And remember, either you subscribe to our podcast or you leave us a nice review on iTunes. Either or. I'm committing a fallacy here. The either or fallacy. Or actually, Keishi, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there's only two options. Either leaving a review or writing a review and posting it on iTunes.
Or subscribing if you enjoyed this podcast. Again, this has been the Side Hustles and Stuff podcast. Usually we talk about side hustles. Today we ventured more into the and stuff part of the podcast. This was episode 31 with Keishi and Yuri.
Talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week. Like if I open my cardboard, again, not cardboard. What are they called? The the shelves above your sink or whatever, the board,
cupboard. Oh, the cupboard.
Yeah. By the way, let me go to the bathroom real quick.
Sure, I'll run
too. Okay.